Someone had noticed in a dictionary that the word father follows the word fathead and comes right before the word fatigue. So to all of you fathead fathers who are fatigued, happy Father's Day. I really did look in the dictionary, and sure enough, there is, first of all, it's hard to find a paper dictionary anymore. But beside that point, these words are all kind of grouped together. So it wasn't just a preacher's tale that I heard. Far too often I find myself on Mother's Day taking some example of a mom in the Bible and talking about how great mothers are. And then on Father's Day, I tend to try to beat up all the dads and say how we need to do better, how we need to be, you know, stronger in our spiritual life and better mentors. And I'm not doing that today. And the reason why is, even though the world, we do celebrate us as human fathers, as was mentioned multiple times already today, we have come together to worship our Heavenly Father. And that is every time we come together. And it is that that I want us to really kind of be thinking about today. Not all have had good fathers. Some have had very difficult fathers, or even sinful fathers, that have brought shame or hurt into their lives. Others, like Andrea, are mourning the loss very recently of a father. And of course, her father just passed away a couple of days ago. And as we surround her and show her our love, we just stop to think about what it means to call God our Father. And I think that that's not as easy, at least for me, as I would like it to be. Some people grew up in churches where they would memorize certain prayers or creeds or doctrinal statements, and they would be a part of their spiritual foundation, a part of how they worshiped, a part of their prayer life. And one of those is considered the Lord's Prayer or the Our Father, depending upon how you want to title that particular prayer. It is an interesting prayer, and I'm going to come back to it here in just a few moments, but it's interesting because it is not a prayer of Jesus, and I hadn't really thought about that fact until I was preparing for this lesson. This isn't us listening into Jesus praying. This is Jesus teaching others how to pray. So this isn't our opportunity to kind of sit and put our ear into this conversation between Jesus and his father. John 17 would probably be the closest to that. This is a teaching that he gives so that we can understand prayer in a much different light. Throughout the Old Testament, the connection to God, or the connection that God had with individuals and then with the nation of Israel, was limited. It was limited in the fact that, yes, we have the entire Old Testament and we have people speaking on behalf of God, but when God actually speaks to someone, or when God's voice is heard by the nation, the general response in any of those cases is tremendous fear. So much so that when they come into that presence of God, they often are down on their knees, or even more so, down on their face, coming before God. Because the very presence of God in a person's life creates this fear. Fear because God is perfect and I am imperfect. So this difficulty that we have of reconciling the two, to be in the presence of that which is perfect, only means that we have to see ourselves for who we really are. And for most of us, we dislike that. And literally going down on the ground is in part our way of not just humbling ourselves before God, but of just seeing ourselves as nothing in the presence of God. Throughout the Old Testament, as you would have these encounters, they would see God as awe, as wonder, as power. And the relationship that they had with God was always kind of at a distance. And the best that they could do was to try to take this, and it's really not the Ark of the Covenant. That's really not the main thing here. It was really what we call the mercy seat on the top of the Ark of the Covenant that was more or less the representation of the physical aspect of God among people. And so they would see that box with that winged being on top of it in that mercy seat that is made from those wings. And that would be the closest they would get in relationship to God. And even in that sense, only the high priest ever went into the Holy of Holies, and he only did that once a year. So to come to the New Testament and to hear Jesus begin to teach and to use the phrase Father, your Father, our Father, I think that's a cultural shift, because they hadn't looked at God quite in that sense. Now they understood that God, you know, they were the children of Israel. In fact, that word is probably used more than the children of God. The children of Israel, they would see God as Abraham's father, and they would see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel, and then their nation coming out. So yes, God is a father, but not in the sense that I had a father that passed away a year and 4 months ago, okay? Not in that same sense. The relationship wasn't in that same sense. So when Jesus comes on the scene, and we get very early on what we call the Sermon on the Mount, throughout the Sermon on the Mount, you're going to find Jesus referring to God as Father. What your Father in heaven sees. You know, what you're doing in private, your Father in heaven sees. And we get this name Father used again and again and again. The opening of that prayer recorded for us by Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount, and then again by Luke with just the disciples, begins by saying, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. The very beginning of that prayer is a call for us to look at life differently. It is a relationship that we have with God built upon the respect of who He is. So much so that His very name needs to be reverenced, needs to be kept holy. And so this idea of praying to God as a Father doesn't diminish the awe aspect that many of the Israelites had. What it does is it adds to that the personal relationship that we get to have that is really there solely because of Jesus Christ. He is the one that is going to make us children. He is going to make us adopted. It is going to be through His blood that we become brothers with Jesus, joint heirs with him. My kids never, okay, on occasion, but only when they're trying to get my attention. My kids do not generally call me Jeffrey. Okay? They just don't. There have been times when we're in a larger group and they're trying to get my attention and the word dad is not being heard, that I will hear one of them say Jeffrey, and knowing their voice and then hearing them say my name has an immediate reaction within me. And I turn to them. There was a time when my oldest son was an adult and we were having a discussion and it was a difference of opinion. And he just goes, dude, you're not listening to me. And I just stopped. And this is serious. I looked at him and I said, I'm not your dude, I'm your dad, and there is a difference. And I needed him to hear that. Now I appreciate the relationship that we have, and I know that in his zeal of our difference of opinion, that he felt like he wasn't being heard, and in his vernacular, the way he would have spoken to anybody else, he was speaking to me, but he also needed to understand that there is a difference between the two of us, that I am his father, and not that I am always right, but there is a difference between him as my child and me as the father. We can have a great close relationship. But I will tell you right now, I don't want to be his dude. I want to be his dad. And there is a difference, a fundamental difference in that. There are some times where a word is used by Jesus to help us deal with relationship. I want to open to Mark chapter 14, and I'm going to begin with verse 32. And I'm going to go through verse 36. I want to read this and then talk about its context here. As I went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. He said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. Going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. When we come to this garden scene just hours before the crucifixion, a very short time before Judas would come into the garden, Jesus says to his disciples, especially to those three that have come a little bit closer, his statement is, my soul is very sorrowful. Jesus says, I am emotionally wrung out. My soul is sorrowful even to the point of death. And Jesus asks them to watch and pray. He asks them to enter into his pain and suffering just simply by being there and lifting him up. Then he goes a little farther, and when he begins to pray, he uses this phrase, Abba, Father. That short little phrase is used only 3 times in the New Testament. This, and then Paul, 2 other times. Most people have heard it said, repeated the statement, that this word Abba is like the word daddy. I get that. But if you really study it, and if you really look at the Aramaic, I think you're going to come to a different conclusion. While it is true that a young child, a baby, speaking out, as we would say, Dada, would say, Abba, that is not what Jesus is doing in the garden. Jesus isn't using baby talk here. It's not what's going on. I understand that in languages today, Abba has that sense of daddy, that familial sense, and that there's truth in that. But it is not used by just little children. It is actually used by grown sons and daughters in reference to their father. It is a term of actual respect for who he is, and because of the relationship that they have together, that he uses this phrase that has been used from the time of being a little child forward. And it is a submission to that will. While the New Testament is written primarily in the Greek language, when Mark gives us this look into the very prayer of Jesus, he uses this phrase and then immediately puts the Greek word father next to it. If he just wanted to use a little child's phrase of daddy, there are Greek words that he could have done that. But he specifically chose to take this particular word to bring out a nuance from it and add to that nuance this statement of father that says, I am in such a relationship with you that there is nobody else that I can be as close to as I can be as close to you. And there is nobody that I see with the power that you have like I see in you. And this cry of Abba, Father, is not meant to teach us to go and call Dad, hey, dude, let's talk. That's not what it is. It is not demeaning who he is. It is entering into a depth of relationship that only can happen between a father and a child, between a good father and a child, between a loving father and a child, between a protective father and a child. That child who grows to be that young man, who grows to be that older man, that walks with that dad as he gets older and older, has such a depth of respect and awe for him that he cries out, Abba, Father. It is that sense that Jesus is praying. And to demean it, I'm not trying to say, never say daddy, but that's just so not the issue here. It's just not. It's an issue of deep connection, reliance upon a greater power than himself that he sees in his father. The other 2 times it is used is by Paul. I want to jump over to Galatians chapter 4. And I want you to hear how this opens up. Galatians 4, beginning with verse 1, Paul writes, I mean that the heir, and this is obvious, the division between chapters and verses sometimes gets so terribly messed up in our Bibles. But he's continuing on with a longer statement. He says, I mean that the heir, as long as he is a child, is no different from a slave, though he is the owner of everything. But he is under the guardians and managers until the date set by the father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. Now listen to this. But when the fullness of time had come, so we're not little kids, okay? But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. The very prayer that Jesus says in John 17, or that Jesus says in Mark 14, that garden prayer of Abba Father, Paul writes and says, we are God's children. And the fact that we are God's children, adopted into that family, growing into that family, means his spirit that cried out, Abba Father, is the same spirit that now rests in us. The other time that is used is Romans 8:15, and again, it's the idea of adoption that is going on there. And because of being adopted, we are able to cry out, Abba, or through the Holy Spirit, we're able to cry out, Abba Father. Those are the only three times the word Abba is used. I will tell you, rarely, so rarely that I cannot think of the last time outside of this past week as I was working on this sermon that I prayed Abba Father. I'll just tell you, those words don't come out of my mouth. They just don't. Okay? When I begin a prayer, I generally begin by saying, Dear God, or Father. I very rarely add the Abba to it. I've been challenging myself to at least think about the Abba part. Because if my prayer isn't centered in this great need for God in my life and for seeing him as the one who loves, protects, feeds, and takes care of me, who has the power over all creation, then really my prayer is not much more than just a formality. But if my spirit is crying out, Abba, Father, and again, it's not Aramaic and in English, forget that. It's the mindset that I want you to take away from. Okay? It's the mindset that if I don't just on bended knee come and say, oh, dear God, my Father in heaven. And again, not prescribing words, but this essence of saying, you're my dad, you're my father, you're the only one who can handle what it is that I am bringing before you right now. And to fall on my knees and to do that, and again, I'm not prescribing, you got to fall on your knees. Just when we see God in that sense, it changes prayer. It just does. It's no longer something that is quickly done before a meal, before a worship service, and I'm not putting that down, before going to bed. It becomes my lifeline, my communication. My way to hear as well as talk. It becomes the solace that I need. That my Abba Father is wrapping his arms around me. When I feel like my world is falling apart. I just need that. And that's the sense that is given through Jesus and then through Paul in this term, Abba, but really from Jesus all the way through his ministry, teaching of a relationship about God as a Father. Before we close out, I want to take you to another passage. I want to go to 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3 begins, John writing. And as you're turning there, and there's so many different translations of chapter or verse 1, John is most likely, I mean, it's very hard to say with 100% certainty, most likely the last living apostle. And most of his writings come much later than the other writings. And many of his writings are to people who did not have a physical connection to Jesus. So they became Christians. They are second or third generation Christians. They're either Gentiles who become Christians or Jewish people who are far enough removed from the cross and the resurrection that they did not have a personal relationship with Jesus. So he writes both his gospel and his letters and the book of Revelation to help us see God. And when we come to what we call chapter 3, John says, see what kind of love the Father has given to us. The ESV, which is what I use, really tries to stay as close to the language as possible. But some of the other translations try to bring out the nuance of the words. And so they will use phrases like, see what type of love the Father has lavished on us. His point is, take a look at the type of love that only comes from God. And here's what his statement is. So when you see what type of love the Father has for us, and this is how he describes it, that we should be called children of God, and so we are. I think John almost probably stopped. And again, I put all of this in my mind's eye. And as he's writing this, and he's talking about the love of God for us, and he says, I want you to understand the love that the Father has for you. And that love is that you were called his child. And that's who you are. The reason the world doesn't know us is it doesn't know him. Beloved, we are God's children now. And what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we will be like him because we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself and he is pure. His point is, John's point is, however things are going to look like in a resurrected body and an eternal soul body, he said, you can argue over that, but I want you to understand the here and now. And the here and now is, you are God's child. And that is a love that is almost beyond explanation. Our daughter that we went on the cruise with, she and her husband are very seriously looking at adoption. And they have their reasons why. That they want to go that particular route. And one of those reasons is there are children who have come into this world that don't get to experience love because of whatever happened in their biological family. And their feeling is maybe we could take one of those kids and just love them. Throughout the New Testament, our type of being a child of God is often referred to as adopted. That God chose us, adopted us into the family. And John's statement is, we are God's kids and he loves us so much that he would sacrifice for us. To become adopted into God's family came at a cost. And he did so because he loved us. Staying in 1 John and going to chapter 4, John would say, beginning in verse 18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. We love because he first loved us. If anyone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him. Whoever loves God must also love his brother. We love because he first loved us. I do not believe we could understand love if we did not understand God. I just don't think we could. And I know I could not understand the depth of what love could mean without walking through, from Genesis through Revelation, walking through the Bible and seeing God's love time and time and time again. We love because he first loved us. As John went on to say, we cannot love God if we hate our brother. I don't know if John had the parable of the prodigal son and the older brother in mind when he wrote this, but it's really fitting here. That older brother in that story that Jesus tells wouldn't even go into the house. He had heard what had happened. He inquired to find out the facts. He knew the facts. So much so that his refusal forced the dad of that particular story, the father of that story, to go out to the son. He had already ran to the younger son, what we call the prodigal son, and now he's going out to the older brother. The father in that particular story loves them both, by the way. I'm not saying the older brother is right at all. I am going to tell you that the father in that story still loved the son. But what John says is, I cannot really love God if I don't really love you. So what God does is he forces us to be a family. He says, you've got to get beyond yourself. You've got to move into seeing the value of people more than you see your own value. And while we do that in many physical families, and we're very supportive of our brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews and cousins and family, God says, that has to happen for real love to take place between you and me. Don't say you love me and still hate the people that I created, your brothers and your sisters. You can't do it. Sometimes we feel great guilt. And so we cry out to God because we feel like that prodigal son. We feel like the person that's messed up. And it's hard to go back home to your father who's done nothing but love you. What I love about 1 John, it's just so much good there. As John would say, even when our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart. You know, I hang a lot on that phrase. I really do. Even when I have a hard time forgiving me, John simply says, Jeffrey, God's already forgiven you. So what are you holding on to? He's greater than your heart. Just be at home with your Father. Respect and love Him. Be in such a relationship with Him that you could not think of praying or being with anybody else and asking for help, that He alone provides it all. Our Father, who is in heaven, holy is His name. That is a prayer I need to say often. And maybe today you've struggled in whatever aspect is with relationships with people or your own father or mother or whoever. And days like today just make you feel horrible on the inside. Because you always want what you think everybody else has. That perfect family over there. Let me just tell you, you've got a perfect Father who gives you a wonderful family. And if we can help you to be in that relationship, then won't you come as we stand and as we sing.